Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good afternoon, everybody here from Chicago. In today's podcast, we have the honor and privilege of interviewing Mr. Justin Beals. He is the co-founder and CEO of StrikeGraph. Justin, thanks for joining our podcast today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm really glad to have a chance to chat about these heavy topics, security, compliance, startups, wherever you want to go. Yeah.
Excellent. Now, how did you start StrikeGraph? Is this the company that you've created on your own or with other partners?
I definitely have a co-founder. Our chief revenue officer is my co-founder, Brian Barrow, and I'm our CEO. And I got interested in the compliance space, not really because I'm a deep security expert. I was actually, you know, my background is as a chief technology officer or a VP of product engineering. But one of the challenges that was happening for a lot of the products that I was building is that the time to close the deal kept extending. Like, we would get a verbal commitment to buy a product that we had developed, but then it might take like 18 months to get a signed contract. And what we were seeing is that a lot of that time was spent in security review from the procurement team at our buyer. And I just got really interested in solving this problem. I think that two things was just really appealed to me personally. One is that I've worked in technology for, you know, 20 years of my career now building product, and the idea that security didn't have to continue to be kind of a cost center, but we could measure and test security in such a way that it could be a sales asset really appealed to me. I thought, you know, this is a great way for us to build a better marketplace for everyone to operate in when we can measure security practices, however rudimentary, but some way of measuring it. And then the other thing that really appealed to me is that I felt like it was a problem I could really help solve, and that there was a lot of opportunity to build innovation around security operations from a compliance perspective. So I founded the company in February of 2020. We were a COVID company for sure, and we've grown really rapidly since then.
Excellent. Now, how did you get the name StrikeGraph? It seems to be a very
That's a great question. The answer is not very glamorous, so I'm just going to own that up front. I've done a lot of startups in my career, and when we were building StrikeGraph or just starting out from a concept perspective, it's really hard to find a name for a company. You know, so many of them are taken and trademarked, and it's hard to get the domain name. And I really wanted two things. One, I wanted it to be English. You know, that's the language of where we're from here in the United States. And that meant plain words, not some weird spelling of something that didn't exist as a word. And it needed to kind of at least speak to what we do on some level. And after many, many days of hunting for the right domain name, StrikeGraph was available. It's good English. And I think the thing that is really appealing to us about it is from a compliance and security perspective, a lot of the foundational value of our technology is this data ontology, all the relationships between risks and controls and the evidence you have to gather to prove control operation and the standards themselves. And so if you think of a graph as a data ontology, you know, StrikeGraph is the solution that kind of pulls together a holistic approach to all that information so that people can operate effectively and reduce the complexity of compliance operations.
Excellent. Now, do you have a presence in other countries besides the U.S. or?
We certainly do. I mean, from a staff perspective, we're a little spread out. We have some staff in Central America area and some staff in Canada. Of course, the bulk of our staff is across the United States. You know, being founded in the middle of COVID, we are, you know, we've kind of dealt with this remote work culture. And I think we've done a really good job about it, actually. The team really enjoys having the flexibility that a remote work culture provides. From a customer perspective, we have customers all over the world, Europe, Australia, Asia Pac, and of course, all across the United States, Canada. We have a fair number of customers in Canada. Some of the standards that we solve for have a geographic kind of history. You know, one that I think of right off the bat is like ISO 27001 has been more highly adopted in Europe than necessarily the United States, where we see a bigger adoption of a standard like SOC 2. But also those type of geography specifics around these standards are change and shift all the time. SOC 2 is very applicable in Europe, even though it's not historically as highly adopted as ISO 27001.
Okay. Now, how much funding have you raised, and from which investors, if you can share that information?
Yeah, so to date, we've raised a total of $12 million in funding. So we're a very capital-efficient organization. We don't believe in fundraising for fundraising's sake. I like to say that our competition is not for the most amount of dollars fundraised, but for the best product on the marketplace for our customers, and we really focus our energy there. We like to take on investment that kind of matches, you know, valid business goals. I started out in the startup space bootstrapping a lot of my companies. So, you know, I see the building of the business as and a great product is what we really need to focus on, making sure that we have the capital to do that effectively, but not really overreaching on valuations, which is certainly something that I think has happened too much in the tech startup ecosystem.
Okay. Now, who is your sweet spot in terms of your customers, and what's the size, the industries, who do you work with primarily?
Yeah, so our sweet spot for customers tends to focus around 50 employees and up. We certainly have a lot of early stage startups that come and work with us. But what we're looking for in all of those organizations is someone with a little bit of experience in doing compliance or being successful in a security style audit. And the reason that we focus on those types of customers is the value proposition of our technology really resonates with those people that have lived the pain of trying to do this work in the past. And typically around 50 employees, a company will identify an owner for the initiative of a SOC 2 audit. And so that's a real nice sweet spot for us. I think that we've seen solutions on the marketplace, we like to call them kind of a checklist solution. They treat every company the exact same. It's the same security checklist for all of them. And our companies, and I think all companies, they're vibrant, they're different, and they need a security posture that matches their business and still gets through the audit or certification that they're looking to strive for. And so StrikeCraft is designed as a platform to not be that singular checklist, but a really robust solution that allows our customers to design a security posture that meets their risk profile. And when you design the right scope security posture, it's a more secure organization and it's more efficient to operate that security.
Okay, excellent. Now, everybody has a different way of looking at risk. Okay, now I wrote a whole book on just on cyber risk and insurance policies. I kind of view risk as, you know, how much of a downturn can you take before your company really starts to, you know, fall off financially if you're hit with a security breach. But in your definition, is what is risk and why is that compliance so important other than not being audited and facing a financial penalty?
Yeah, so let's start on the why is the audit itself valuable, because I think that's the real driver as to why StrikeCraft has been growing so quickly, and we've seen really a lot of money spent in this space. Happened is that the risk of a third-party breach at most buyers of technology in the marketplace is so great that they need some effective way of assessing a vendor's maturity from a security perspective, from a process perspective, from a general business practices perspective. And so when you're in a sales motion with a buyer, you're going to get asked from that procurement team about your security practice. And if you've had an independent assessment done of your security practice, do a standard like SOC 2, it answers a lot of questions for that buyer in that procurement department that makes it easier and more efficient to close the deal. So this is a revenue problem. That's what StrikeCraft likes to consider ourselves as solving. And I was on a sales call today with a potential customer, and that's exactly what they're experiencing. They have a great company. It's been around for 10 years. The buyers of their solution are starting to ask for more maturity from their vendors, and there's an expectation that they have an independent audit or assessment of their security practices to an acceptable standard for them to renew their contract. Now, so that's, you know, that's a risk that every company sits up and looks at pretty quickly, right? You know, revenue as a risk. And that's really been the number one reason that people have been going and doing this. Now, from a, like the perspective of what security do I need to implement, the way we think about risk in our platform is it has a lot to do with your organization, what's valuable that you store or do, and what impact that could have if you were unable to do that work or store that data or keep it private. And data there is a critical word, right? Like so much of the security practices that we decide to do are wrapped in what we do with our customers' information that they share with us. And so when we think about risk in our platform, as people are analyzing a risk profile and the controls they might implement to mitigate that risk, you know, there's everything from, you know, are you storing customer data in a database, in a cloud provider? And if that's a risk, then there are certain controls you might want to implement, like encryption of that data at rest and appropriate access management for who can access that data.
Okay, excellent. Now let's get into your platform. It looks like, you know, you can help companies achieve various or numerous types of security certs. Can you share which certs that you those are?
Yeah. So today we are supporting SOC 2, Type 1 and Type 2, all five of the trust criteria for the SOC 2 standard. ISO 27001 and 27002, and we also support the new ISO privacy standard, ISO 27701, which is also a great proxy for a lot of the other privacy standards from GDPR to California Consumer Privacy. And so it's a good umbrella privacy standard. We support PCI DSS. We support HIPAA. We support CMMC or NIST 800-171. And then we're getting ready to launch FedRAMP, which I believe is the NIST 853 standard here pretty soon.
Well, what are your thoughts on the CMMC? It's been kind of a very messed up process, I would think. And I think they're now mandating that CMMC 2.0 starts in March. What are your thoughts on the whole thing?
Yeah, I think it's really complicated. But, of course, you know, leave it to an organization as massive as the Department of Defense to kind of define a very complicated solution. So I think for all of these standards, there are valid criticisms for how they've been implemented. You know, the tiering system in CMMC makes it three times as complicated as a singular standard, right? And then finding a certifying body to do the testing is also can be very complicated. And there is tiers of reporting, you know, I think in some implementations, there's a quarterly reporting to the testing team on your implementation or effective practices. And it's really hard, but the Department of Defense is trying to handle it. I mean, if you go read the NIST 853 standard, the really big long one, you know, there are test cases in there for confidential data all the way through to top secret. And if you're a vendor for the Department of Defense and you're dealing with top secret information, I think that there's an understandable level of rigor. What I hope from all of the teams that continue to write these standards is that it's got to be a method of constant improvement. So you can't just publish a standard and kind of abandon it. You need to be leaned in with continuing to improve the standard, make it easier to use, more effective to test, and also, you know, provide that trust and confidence when you do pass the certification that you've been effective in your practices. They're all challenged in some way. I haven't met a standard that you can complain about on some level. Yeah.
Now, do you have any, are you like a C3APO, I think they call that, or are you like a risk assessor for the CMC?
Yeah, we're not a C3PAO yet, but one of the really big innovations that StrikeRaf has provided is that we've gone beyond simple audit prep and into the realm of testing, literally testing the security practices that in the past would have been done by hand, by just an individual. And so for some of the standards like SOC 2, and I think in Q1 we're going to be launching a HIPAA certification, we have on staff ISACA credentialed certified information systems auditors and a testing audit team for security where we're able to perform the testing. And we utilize a lot of technology to make that testing transparent. And I think that's a big philosophy for us. You know, in the past, where all this testing had to be done by hand, independence was a big buzzword about the trustworthiness of the assessment. But as we're able to provide innovation that automates the testing, what becomes critical is not necessarily independence, because we can provide deep transparency into everything that was tested, the repeatability of the testing, so if it needs to be retested, it can, and the outcome of that testing. And I think that transparency over time is going to eat into this concept of kind of ivory tower independence, which is a fallacy unto itself, because from a C3PAO to, you know, a certified public auditing firm, they have a financial relationship with the buyer of the test. So complete independence is impossible.
Okay, excellent. Now, can you tell us more about your products? You use AI or artificial intelligence and machine learning technology in them?
Yeah, definitely. And I've done a lot of work in my career as a product person and a chief technology officer in creating machine learning and data science solutions that are AI features for our customers. I think to talk about what our solution is at a high level, the way we like to describe it is, you know, StrikeRaf is a compliance operations and assurance platform. So we handle the compliance operations to a security standard that you want to achieve and through the testing process with really valuable technology to make that very efficient and an effective testing. When we talk about compliance operation, we're talking about three main aspects. Our platform allows you to design a security posture that meets the standards that you would like to meet. So what security scope should we have? Then it allows you to distribute the ownership of those security controls or habits that you're adopting across your broader organization. So the owner of employee onboarding and offboarding might be the VP of HR, you know, not the CISO. It's the wrong place to put it probably. And then finally, we have API integration in our solution that allows us to automatically collect evidence from like AWS or Azure or your HRIS system so that we can reduce the amount of clicking that people have to do to prove that they operated the controls effectively. Finally, as all that data is aggregated underneath the platform, we're prepared to take it into testing and provide certifications, audits, and reports that prove that that our customer has been operating that security posture effectively. When you ask about AI and ML, there's really two critical areas where we're heavily invested in providing a solution. One is on the testing side, we can use data science as a really effective tool for looking for discrepancies in the evidence over time to prove that they've been operating the control effectively. So if you start out on StrikeGraph and you've got a firewall configuration on your VPC in AWS, and we're tracking that automatically every month to pull the latest VPC configuration, AI can help us look for, has this configuration changed over time, and does that represent a lapse in the security control itself being operated? The second area that's really powerful where we've been doing a lot of AI ML work is, we all hate these security questionnaires. As a CTO, I used to get a ton of them. Some of them are like 600 questions long. And we built some natural language processing tools to essentially go into your data set on StrikeGraph and answer each of the questions that comes in a security questionnaire. And so that's been a really valuable feature as well.
Now, do you guys do pen testing also?
We do. We provide our customers with pen testing. We have certified penetration testers on staff. And we focus our pen testing around the standard that a particular customer might be trying to accomplish. So there's a pen test configuration that we provide for someone that's doing SOC 2. There's a slightly different configuration for someone that's looking for ISO 27001. It can be a slightly more rigorous penetration testing process. But I found that the pen test is a sales asset unto itself. I think you can get away with a SOC 2 audit with just a vulnerability scan. But a lot of enterprise customers are savvy enough to say, well, that's great, you did a vulnerability scan, but I want a real annual certified pen tester doing a red team exercise against your software.
Okay. Now, the two big buzzwords in pen testing are autonomous and automatic. I mean, I've talked to a lot of pen testers, and they've tried to come out, you know, can products that can, they're automatic and autonomous. You know, they don't have to hire, you know, the pen testing team. What are your thoughts on that?
I think a hybrid approach is really the solution today. And the reason, so one thing to understand about most of the tests that are run from a pen testing perspective is that there's good tool set to operate a fair number of them. You know, I know that we use tools like Burp Suite, very common in the pen testing world, to kind of identify the tests we want to run, make sure that the tests we want to run have the right configuration, and then allow the tests to run. But the problem with like this concept of fully automated is that really each customer's configuration is unique. You know, they may be, sure, they might have a classic kind of web server somewhere that you're trying to do the penetration test against. But they also might have an API set up that's a whole different gateway into the system, and they may have configured that differently. And so now you need someone with training as a pen tester to configure how you're going to run those tests against those APIs. The second thing is that, you know, even when I was a chief technology officer, I'd like to say that every single pen test I ever had done on us was a clean slate. It wasn't. It was always one or two findings that we needed to go fix. And that's the second thing, is talking with a penetration tester post the pen test about what failed and how to fix it and get some clear indication on what the problem was is a really critical aspect as well. So I don't think, I personally, if I were a buyer in the marketplace, I'm not sure I would trust a fully automated pen test. That sounds like a vulnerability scan to me. But I am really open-minded about the hybrid model of pen testing, where you have someone with expertise making sure things are configured for the right coverage of testing, and then on the back end of the testing, helping them understand how to resolve certain issues that might have cropped up.
Okay, excellent. Now, how many total clients have you helped to achieve their certs?
So we have over 200 customers at this point. You know, we're not quite 3 years old now. We have grown exponentially. We grew like 15x in our first year, and we had like a 4 or 5x the second year. This year is almost a 3x growth year for us. And the reason is the same reason that I had when I was a CTO for founding the company, is that these are becoming critical sales assets. And honestly, it's really nice to have a standard to kind of get tested against, to feel confident that if you're not a deep security expert, you've implemented or met a bar for broad business security activities in your organization. And one of the things that shocked me about this marketplace when I was researching it is in 2019, non-financial audits and audit services accounted for $100 billion global spend. And easily 90% of that is going to consulting companies as opposed to technology-centric solutions. And on top of that, it had been growing at a 10 to 15% rate of increase for over a decade. And I think we're only going to see acceleration. I think we're all, you know, in the amount of spend around this, I think we're only going to see more innovation in this space to create a more trusted cert and a more efficiently acquired cert. And I also think we're going to see more rigorous certifications coming out as, of course, more risks appear in a even more porous marketplace where we share more and more data even more and more easily.
Thank you. Excellent. What are the key steps to achieve compliance? Does each cert have their own unique steps, or it's kind of like a one-size-fits-all approach that you make use of?
Yeah, I think, you know, I can build a broad perspective, and we can talk about how some of the different standards kind of change the dynamic a little bit. The first thing that we always recommend is before you ever go look at the standard, just really focus on your business, your risk, and the security activities that make sense. We have services businesses that don't have a SaaS software that they offer, and their risks are very different than a customer of ours that might have a fintech solution that needs like a lot of rigor around change management, for example, whereas a services business might not. And one of the secrets about compliance is that when you go in for an audit or a certification, if there's a part of the standard that doesn't apply to your business, you're not required to prove activities around that. So even the testing phase of the standard is malleable from the perspective of what matters, you know, what is an actual risk for this business that we do need to test for effective change management processes. So that's why we like to focus on what is the security posture that fits your business first before we ever even talk about the standard. Next, once you've defined, and we do a control-centric design, so it's really nice, like here's 2 to 3 sentences about encryption at rest. This is our control for our company for encryption at rest, and we know we want to do that control. So once that's defined, it needs to be assigned to the right owner. And I think that's one common misconception about these standards is that, you know, oh, our CTO will, or CISO, or this one person that's nominated is kind of the owner of our SOC 2 compliance. It's actually a company-wide activity. And you need to assign the control ownership for HR activities and fraud activities and change management activities to the appropriate owners inside of your organization. That creates better security because you're spreading out the footprint of people actively owning some portion of security across your whole organization. So that's the second broad step. And then as you collect that evidence that you operated that control, then you're, once you've accrued enough of that evidence, you're ready to go into testing with an auditor and make sure that you meet the standard fully. Now, SOC 2 and ISO 27001, I like to call these like general business security standards. So they're pretty applicable across different verticals. Both of them have very specific testing methodologies. So the SOC 2 standard specifies how to get an audit and receive a report. ISO 27001 is similar. It specifies how to get an audit, or if you want to go for full certification, how to get through the certification process. They're not vertically aligned. They're kind of, you know, we've seen fintech companies get them. And then they also might get something that is vertically aligned, like PCI DSS. And to give you an example about PCI DSS, it has an assessment methodology defined. There are four tiers to PCI DSS. Tier one is typically organizations that are doing more than 1 million transactions in a year. And that is a very rigorous, you know, independent audit of the PCI DSS standard for that organization. But if you're 2, 3, or 4, you can get a much more lightweight audit or a self-assessment, and that's written in the PCI DSS standard from an assessment methodology. But each of them have some nuance to how they are tested and certified. And StrikeGraph, as a solution for our customers, provides the deep expertise. And if you're thinking about achieving this standard, where's the rubber meet the road to getting there and getting there efficiently?
Well, excellent. Now, do you have any customer success stories that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think one of the things that we've been super excited about is actually watching customers start out their journey with a very small standard as a small organization. They had a very successful product in the marketplace, and now they're starting to grow. And so we had a customer that was, a small group, maybe 7 people. They had an AI solution that did testing for fraud in financial statements. And they were clicking along with the SOC 2. They were doing pretty good. But then they had a customer come to them and say, hey, we need to do an investigation on a healthcare organization, and it's going to involve sharing patient healthcare information with you. And we need to know if you're HIPAA compliant. Otherwise, we can't share, you know, can't do the project with you. And so we looked at that customer, and we were able to identify almost instantly the gap they had between their current security practices and meeting HIPAA. And they only had to add like 10 controls to their company operation to be HIPAA compliant and win the deal. And so that's really powerful, right? Like if you want to break into a new vertical and you don't want to have to do like a ground up HIPAA standard implementation, our solution is already mapped across multiple standards for you. And so we tell you instantly how much work is required to meet that new requirement and close that deal. I think the other thing we're really proud of is, you know, we have some very large customers that are utilizing the StrikeGraph platform as well as these small customers. So I know of at least 1 or 2 customers that started with us and have IPO'd while they were on the StrikeGraph platform. And that rigor on the security side helped them get through the IPO process from a maturity perspective.
Okay, excellent. Now, as we segue into the last part of our show here, talk about some cyber issues here, but before we do that, what are your general plans for your company to expand? Are you planning to offer new products and services or enter new markets on a global basis?
Yeah, I think all of those are true. And I guess as a CEO, I'm aggressive about growth, which is probably something my board likes. One aspect that we're always growing is we're expanding the number of standards that we support. So you know, for instance, launching FedRAMP here in the next month or so is going to be a really valuable standard in our platform that our customers or future customers may utilize to continue their compliance journey. And so we're always adding new standards to the platform. And as fast as we can add them, it seems like people invent new ones. And so we'll probably always do that. The other thing that we're really expanding quite a bit is, and we've invested a lot in it in the last year and a half, is to automate testing and increase the effectiveness of automated testing that was typically done by hand, by a human being, maybe in an auditor role in the past. And we think that that is really the value pinnacle for our customers. You know, when right now we can deliver a SOC 2 report in about, you know, a quarter of the time that a CPA firm might be able to. And that all comes down to technology's ability to accelerate the testing. And we're heavily invested in continuing to expand that technology moat from all of our competitors and eat into what has traditionally been a consultative practice that's kind of fraught with human opinion as opposed to transparency in testing. So that's a deep investment for us. We're going to launch a HIPAA certificate this quarter. We're doing ISO 27001 audits. We're doing SOC 2 testing, and it's just been a huge value add for our customers not to deal with big consulting firms to get through that process. So I think that's another big investment for us.
Excellent. Now, Justin, there are probably, what, 2,000 or 3,000 other cyber vendors out here in the U.S.
Yeah.
Why should a customer come to you for, like, helping them with their compliance efforts versus somebody else? In other words, what makes you different from the rest of the crowd? Your one unique defining criteria.
Yeah, I think that there are a couple things that really stand out about us. And I want to segment a little bit. You know, one of the things I tell our customers all the time is that we don't make you more secure by simply signing a contract with StrikeRaft. Our philosophy is that you operate your security, and there are vendors out there that have specific security solutions that will make you more secure, like a firewall vendor or a background check vendor or things like that. And so, but that's not kind of what we do. We're a business system that takes in the inputs from those security vendors and make sure that they're rolling up to an audit or certification that you would like to achieve. I think that from the competitors that we have that focus on compliance solutions, there's two things that are very powerful about a StrikeRaft relationship. One is we do the testing. We're one of the few teams that offers that. That's not a consultative, very expensive process. And it's a huge innovation in the marketplace, and it's fairly disruptive, and we're seeing a lot of customer success around it. The second thing is that our whole philosophy is that every customer is unique. So we expect every customer to have a different security posture. That is good security, and it's efficiently operated security, and that's a virtuous cycle. And so instead of you coming to us and us saying, hey, give us this list of 150 things and you must write this policy no matter what, we don't do that. We say, you know, you told us what security you wanted to operate it. We confirmed that that met the standard you're trying to achieve. And based on that operation, this is the type of evidence, you know, testing will expect for you to be successful. And so that flexibility in our platform, that treating each customer uniquely and building technology that allows us to do that, that's incredibly powerful.
Okay, excellent. Now, Justin, the C-suite, you know, I think, I wrote a blog about this, I think, some time ago. I think the CIO doesn't exist anymore. The CISO is going to be outphased this year. Now there's a new trend called the VCISO. What are your thoughts on that?
Is the DCISO a deputy CISO?
A VCISO is like a CISO, but you hire them on a contract basis as needed.
Oh, I gotcha. Yeah. Yeah. I think we have seen the CISO role be very expensive.
Right.
It's just a really unique talent set, and we see it hired more at more robust companies. And I think the old school way of thinking about security as a cost center has kind of driven people to try and minimize that work. I think at an organization of a certain size, and I'm thinking here of the 50 to 75 employee range, depending on the risk, having someone lead the initiative for security operations, not cybersecurity only, but security operations across the organization, is really valid. But if you have patient healthcare information, for example, critical financial information that you're storing, I do think that you need to bring in a dedicated cybersecurity expert, because your core value is wrapped up in a nice, tidy package somewhere on AWS or Azure, and if it's not configured properly, it's at risk. And I had a conversation with a customer not too long ago, and they had done an analysis of the value of their data. And they were surprised to learn that on the black market, their database was probably worth between $70 and $100 million. And when you understand the value of the data you're storing, how, you know, what that looks like to a hacker, I think the risk becomes a lot more plain all of a sudden that someone's going to try to get their hands on it because it's worth so much money. And so I just think you need to be aware, right? Like, it's, you don't want to wear a lot of jewelry in a rough neighborhood. Not a good idea. I think we have seen the like part-time CISO work, and I think for mid-sized organizations, at least they're getting some valuable input from an expert in cybersecurity, and I always think that's helpful. Yeah.
Okay, excellent. Now, the next thing is that we're going to be talking about some threats here this year and in the future. Nation-state threat actors, you know, like North Korea, Iran, China, you know, blah, blah, blah. What are your thoughts on that? Or do you think we'll see more cyber attacks as more of a homegrown, like domestic terrorism kind of thing?
Oh, I think both are only going to grow. You could imagine where an organization might be more susceptible to a nation state. Of course, it's going to be anybody that's dealing with U.S. military, a U.S. government, or access to those entities, someone with trade secrets or patent and innovation that speaks to the capability of a nation state. And it's always surprising what those types of things could be. It could be, you know, like some very powerful AI feature system. You know, I could see the OpenAI organization being very susceptible to something like a nation state hack who would like to have access to how, to the data set that those models were created on, let alone the actual model predictions themselves, so that they could continue to operate them and build tools around them. So it's going to exist. It's going to be out there, but certain organizations are going to have a higher risk for it than others. I think the second aspect is going to be crime and fraud, and that's going to always be a very concerted effort to execute an effective hack, whether you're selling personal information online, ransomware attacks for money. And then, of course, there's the cross-connect. You know, a nation-state actor just trying to demoralize confidence in the U.S. business as an economic leader may attempt a ransomware attack on just a high-profile organization. Our internet is highly connected. Data likes to live in connected spaces, and you're just going to have to be really eyes wide open about the value opportunity for a hacker and the risk that presents for your organization.
Okay. Excellent. Now, I'm right now writing two books on the Zero Trust framework. And in the first book, I've talked about the perimeter defense model and how that doesn't work anymore. And I got into the basic Zero Trust and some of the issues with that. So I'm kind of coming up with my own model and seeing how the quantum mechanics can work with that. Have you had any talk with any of your clients about Zero Trust? Complaint?
You know, it crops up every once in a while. I would say the struggle with it for our customers has been that it's not a highly defined like standard, like we might get from the ISO governing body, right? It feels a little ephemeral to them on how to define it. So your work around helping define what that means is super helpful for Zero Trust to even be valid as a practice. Because if it's kind of a concept that people make up for their own outcomes, it's going to be hard to measure. And I think we're moving in as a security culture into measurable security spaces. That's what all these standards are about and the audits and certs. And I think that there's going to be an expectation for Zero Trust similarly as it matures. And we at StrikeCraft have thought about trying to write a Zero Trust style standard that we can use as a rubric to test against. And we're constantly kind of monitoring to see if the community has kind of come to a definition that we can wrap a rubric around.
Cool. Well, when I get these two books done or published, I'll send you some copies too, okay?
We'll give you deep attribution, if not a royalty, for every customer that wants to meet your standard.
Well, I don't even know how I'd come up with this model. It's something that I feel like it's like a doctoral dissertation. But hey, mm-hmm. So just a couple more issues here. Now, you touched about the remote workforce. When COVID hit, nobody expected the world would be going to turn upside down the way it did.
Right.
Now, workforce is pretty much here. People are talking about a hybrid workforce. I haven't really seen any of that yet. What are your thoughts on that? Are we going to be a 99% remote workforce now going in the future, or there's some hybridization along there somewhere?
Somebody made a statement to me about it, and I think it resonated that essentially what COVID did is it, in 2 years, it pushed us into remote workforce that was planned 10 years out. So we kind of accelerated the remote nature of work by leaps and bounds really, really quickly. And it exposed some issues from a security perspective with the workforce stuff. I always think about the Colonial Pipeline hack. I think it was 2020 or 2021. And it had a lot to do with now engineers were working from home on laptops with data there, and that allowed for access that hadn't been outside the office in the past. There'll be a little bit of pullback, but certainly employees are resistant to it. And I, as our founder CEO, have, you know, if you had asked me in February of 2020 what I was most excited about founding StrikeCraft, it would have been like coming into the office and working with the team every day. I couldn't do that. That wasn't, you know, an opportunity for us. Instead, we had to build a culture around being remote and working effectively. And I myself have taken advantage of it. I kind of moved out of the downtown Seattle where I was living to a little village out in the farmland, and I quite like it. So I think at a minimum, you know, there'll be a little pullback and people will try the hybrid thing again. But I think especially for tech companies where so much of our work is done on a laptop, if not all of it, that the Band-Aid has been ripped off in some way, and it's going to be really hard to put it back on.
Okay. Cool. Now, just to cut one or two more things, the Internet of Things, I find that to be a very scary proposition. You know, everything's all connected. I don't have anything like a smart home or a smart car. I'm kind of an old-fashioned guy, and the only mobile app I really have on my iPhone is for my email. What are your thoughts on the IoT? Do you have like a smart car or smart home or anything like that? Or
I installed the Philips Hue lighting system in my house, and it certainly ships some data around, and you could tell a lot about that data. Probably you could be like, oh, like Justin has the really like soft red lights going. They must be getting ready for bed or something. So one of the things I'll say about the IoT stuff, though, is that I don't think that the products are very mature. So I have some criticisms of the product itself for the lighting, the smart lighting tools that we have. But it also has helped, like when I'm on the road, it's given me access to a camera outside. You know, recently in our village, there was some flooding. And so I had the ability to just check and see what was going on. So that was quite nice. I think it's going to continue to proliferate, but I think the products themselves have to mature from the value they provide versus the pain and suffering of having to stare at my phone to turn on my lights or not. Right. And so I'm kind of looking for a continued rapid improvement of what those technologies do, how easy they are to install, and how well they do at keeping my data private.
Okay. Now, one last question on issues. Did you hear about the FAA shutting down the U.S. airspace for about an hour and a half yesterday or 2 days ago?
Yeah.
Do you think that was a cyber attack or just more of a computer glitch?
I don't have data really to assume one way or the other. Having been a CTO and released bugs into production in the past, I would not be surprised that it was a cyber glitch or just a release issue or a bug or an upgrade that kind of failed and needed to be rolled back. It also could have been a cyber attack. I haven't read that deeply on it, but I'm always loath to assume where we don't have real information about what might have happened. What it does point out, however, is that the availability of software today is critical to the economic operation of the United States, let alone the world. And further, continuing to further our ability to test ourselves on the resiliency of those operations, the security of those operations, is going to be really important. And that's going to continue to, in a good way for StrikeGraph, expand our opportunity to provide the broader marketplace with value. So that's exactly where we want to be. We want our customers to, develop a good security posture, but to be tested on it and to feel confident that they're operating it effectively. So it certainly was a big hit. It had a massive impact economically I can't imagine the number of people that were impacted by not being able to get on a plane for an hour and a half, being doing lots of travel for my job. That's a painful morning for sure.
Especially the cold weather we had for Christmas, right?
That's right. Anyway. Yes, yeah, exactly.
So,
yeah.
Anyway, as we wrap up our show, Justin, how do you think the cyber threat landscape's going to evolve this year? And do you have any tips for people to mitigate the risks of not becoming a victim? Now, we all are at risk of being a victim. But what's like the best way we can mitigate that risk?
Yeah, I think the number one way, at least in the next year, is continue to improve each human being's understanding of how attacks are executed and how to keep things safe. And that's everyone from, you know, my executive assistant that helps me look through my emails, and you know, they're looking at people that are trying to glean information from me or hack or something like that. And so I just think that it's almost like, you know, the old media classes we used to have to take to understand the difference between yellow journalism and good journalism. I think similarly, we've got to understand how interconnected these systems are. And the one thing that you can probably change quite quickly is your team's knowledge of how certain hacks are executed and how to be aware and be a good consumer of computing systems. Now, one thing that I am a little concerned with, and I think this is more of a 5-year issue, but it could have a massive impact, is I think the ability of quantum computing to crack common encryption technologies that we use today is accelerating faster than we thought it would. So we're not like 100 years away or 50 years away of quantum computers being able to crack common encryption methods. We may be as little as 5 years away. And that's pretty scary, because so much of our data transfer trust is based upon 256-bit encryption, that if we have to start bumping, you know, exponentially beyond that, I think there's a fear for me fundamentally on the ability to keep data private as it crosses the wire.
Okay. Now, Justin, what's finally our last question here. What's the best way for someone to get hold of you if they want your services?
Yeah, our website, strikecraft.com, not only has a ton of information, but you can book a meeting for a demo of our product right on the website, or we have a great chat solution, and it's staffed with teammates 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. Pacific time every day. So if someone would like to chat with one of our teammates, they can do it right from the website. I'm most active from a social media perspective on LinkedIn. That shows you how old I am. And so if someone was interested in contacting me specifically, LinkedIn is really a great way. And I'm also a Mastodon user, but that's I think that's a more arcane corner of the social media landscape than these days, yeah.
Okay, cool. Well, Justin, we thank you for your time this afternoon, and I think you've shed a lot of insight now as to your services and how an owner or business owner could, you know, use your services, especially when it comes to CMMC. Thanks for your time.
It's insightful questions. Always a pleasure. Yeah.
We hope to have you again. In fact, maybe we can schedule you out in a few months once the CMMC 2.0 takes over, and kind of get your thoughts on that.
I'd be happy to. Absolutely.
Thanks for your time.